Hello, everyone, and welcome to Science and Society, Our World, Our Well-Being, Our Future. I'm Dr. David Lemberg. The Science and Society mission is to promote and support the public understanding and awareness of science and to promote and support math and science education. Please visit us online at scienceandsociety.net. Today's special guest is Dr. Anna Malinow, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine, located in Houston, Texas. She is full-time faculty at the Ben Taub General Hospital Pediatric Emergency and Ambulatory Center. Dr. Malinow's experiences with the underserved in Cleveland and Houston motivated her in 2002 to co-found Healthcare for All Texas and to promote single-payer universal health care through education and policy setting. Dr. Malinow has been a guest speaker on healthcare reform at local and national lectures and has been featured on multiple television and radio programs. She is the author of numerous op-ed articles and is past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome, Dr. Anna Malinow.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Anna, thank you for being with us on Science and Society today. Well, could we start off by talking about why you yourself got involved in healthcare reform?
Well, as you mentioned in my introduction, and thank you very much for that introduction, I have been a pediatrician here in Texas for about 11 years. And as many of your listeners probably know, Texas ranks number one in the percent of uninsured in the country. I live in a city where we have 1.1 million uninsured people. And I found myself more and more taking care, of course, of children who were uninsured in our county hospital. Anywhere from 60% to 70% of our children don't have a medical home, and which is a staggering statistic. I found that I was taking care of their insurance problems more than the actual medical problems. And so someone would come in, I'd be able to make the diagnosis and get them the right antibiotic, but really my main concern was, were they going to be able to afford the antibiotic? Were they actually going to be able to take it if they needed an EKG or a chest x-ray or a subspecialist? Were we going to be able to get those extra tests? And so much of my time really was taken up by trying to help our parents navigate our healthcare system. And I got to the point where, yes, I was helping one patient at a time. I became really frustrated, and I thought, well, maybe I needed to do something more systemic about this.
Mm-hmm. Anna, thank you very much. So can we look at the U.S. healthcare system itself? Most commentators will agree that it is badly broken. What are the characteristics that can be improved, and where can reform actually take place?
Well, I think that if we start looking at the healthcare system as it is, it might give us a few clues as to how we should go about reforming it. Number one, it is hugely expensive, and so any kind of reform that we integrate into our healthcare system has got to take care of costs. Secondly, it is hugely fragmented. There are over 1,300 insurance companies. And for example, I understand that in Chicago alone, there's something like 17,000 healthcare plans.
Right.
Then, of course, you've got the new Medicare Part D with 1,800 standalone, sort of pharmacy go-betweens for our poor seniors that they have to try to navigate that. Then there are multiple Medicaid HMOs, and then SCHIP, that's the Children's Health Insurance HMOs, and so it is a hugely fragmented system that makes for about a 30% overhead on administration and profit alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, any kind of a healthcare system that we design has got to make sure that we take care of costs and that we take care of the fragmentation. So there are many other things that we need to improve about our healthcare system. For example, a much greater emphasis on primary care, an emphasis on preventive care, on public health care, and so forth. But right now, I think that we have our hands full with trying to create a healthcare system that will, in fact, take care of costs and the fragmentation. And so I think that that's really where we need to go. The costs of our healthcare system are tremendous. We spend over $2.2 trillion every year on healthcare. Unfortunately, because we are a for-profit healthcare system, the only one in the industrialized world that actually allows healthcare industry to make a profit, then, of course, there's going to be very, very little incentive to keep costs down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, somebody takes home $2.2 trillion every year.
Right.
And it's not this little pediatrician here. I can assure you. Our system is predicated on profits, and so and as long as it's predicated on profits, it's a capitalist system. And let's not kid ourselves that, you know, in capitalism, the bottom line is the bottom line is to make a profit, and so that's what our insurance industry is doing. It's making a profit off of healthcare, and the only way that the insurance companies can make a profit off of healthcare are by two things. One is choosing the right person to insure, right? I.e., healthy, young, with money, and two is by denying health care.
Right.
And so we have this huge, huge monster between the patient and health care that is actually sucking up all the money and giving us no value whatsoever for into our health care system.
Anna, thank you. So can we talk about no value despite over $2 trillion annually? U.S. healthcare ranks poorly in terms of global metrics.
You're right. It does. We have the highest infant mortality of the industrialized countries, the lowest life expectancy, the highest maternal mortality. We do not have as many CT scanners and MRI scanners, believe it or not, as other countries such as Japan. We have fewer hospitals per capita, fewer hospital beds, fewer nurses, fewer physicians per capita than many of the industrialized countries, and yet we outspend every industrialized country by twice as much, as you know. So what the big problem is, of course, is that we're not getting our money's worth. It's not to say that we need to spend less money. That's not really what we're advocating. We're advocating that we need to spend the kind of money that we're spending so that, in fact, everybody can have good health care in the United States.
Yes.
But that 30% that goes to administration and profit really needs to go to health care.
Yes, Anna, thank you. So let's talk about everybody receiving quality health care in the U.S. What about the Massachusetts model? Is that workable on a national scale?
Well, okay, let's take, again, the two things that we... maybe we have not agreed on, but the two things that I said we really had to take care of in order to have a healthcare system, a quality healthcare system for everyone, and that is make sure that we contain costs and make sure that we do not have a fragmented healthcare system. Well, the Massachusetts model does neither. It is hugely expensive. It is a $1 billion Band-Aid. And it allows a company like Blue Cross Blue Shield to make $1 million in profit a month there. And that's where the money is going. And that's why from 2007 to 2008, there was a 42% increase in healthcare costs. And it's projected to increase even more, which is more than the national average, which is maybe like 10%. It's projected to increase 17% in 1 year between... Well, actually, that was last year. I'm sorry. I don't even have the projections for next year. But at any rate, it is not containing costs. So we cannot take a model like Massachusetts that only had 500,000 uninsured. Okay, we have 46, 47 million uninsured. Massachusetts had about 500,000, 500,000. And in addition, it's a very, very rich state that has a healthy income tax, state income tax, that spends an awful lot of money on health and human services. And it's not something that can be generalized to the entire country. Let me just give you an example. As far as like the public health insurance that Massachusetts residents had compared to the public system that people in Texas have.
Okay.
So, before Massachusetts had their universal health care bill, if you were an adult in Texas, whether you were a working adult or a non-working adult, you could make up to 133% of the federal poverty level and qualify for Medicaid. So 100% of the federal poverty level for a family of four is about $20,000. So you could make over $20,000 a year and qualify for Medicaid. Okay?
Right.
That was their baseline. Now, in Texas, the way we have it right now, if you are a working parent, you can make up to 30% of the federal poverty level. That's $6,000 a year in order to qualify for Medicaid. And if you make more than $6,000 a year, you cannot qualify for Medicaid.
Hmm.
And that's a working parent, because right. a non-working parent can only make up to 16% of the federal poverty level
right.
and qualify for Medicaid. So do you see where many of the other states are starting from?
Hmm.
And that's the reason why we have almost 6 million uninsured. One of the reasons, not all.
Uh-huh.
One of the reasons why we have 6 million uninsured in Texas as opposed to 500,000 in a state like Massachusetts. And so when you start adding up all these states that, in fact, do not have very many people in the public health insurance sector, you have a lot more people that you're going to have to cover with public health insurance, because that is how Massachusetts is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing it by mandating that everybody have some form of health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
If they can afford it, according to their calculation, then they have to buy private health insurance. If they can't afford it, then they buy private health insurance with a subsidy from the government,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of that $1 billion Band-Aid mm-hmm. that goes to Blue Cross Blue Shield. And if they meet certain federal guidelines, such as I believe now it's like 100% of the federal poverty level, then they can actually qualify for Medicaid. And so the bulk of the people that have increased because Massachusetts has decreased the number of uninsured,
mm-hmm.
but the bulk of those uninsured has come from people that are now qualifying for Medicaid.
Right.
And Medicaid is obviously it's paid for by the federal government and by the state government. And so it's the state government that's putting in an awful lot of money in there to make sure that the residents are getting public health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And in Texas, I always tell my students this. What if we were to raise in Texas the qualifications for Medicaid from, 30% of the federal poverty level, say to 200% of the federal poverty level, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because, in fact, otherwise you look at spending anywhere from 25 to 30% of your income to pay for private health insurance in Texas.
Right, right.
Okay? So say that you raise it up to 200% of the federal poverty level, and then you're going to get Medicaid. Well, 43% of the people in Texas live at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. That means that almost 50% of the people in Texas are automatically going to get Medicaid, which is going to be paid for in part by Texas.
Right.
So the
right.
math doesn't even add up.
Right.
So the Massachusetts plan is something that is hardly working at all in Massachusetts. It's going to be very, very costly. It does not at all get rid of the fragmentation, so that it increases profits, it increases administration, and it cannot be generalizable to the rest of the United States, because it's just going to go bankrupt, basically. It's a system that's designed to go bankrupt.
Thank you very much for that detailed analysis.
Did that make sense?
It makes total sense.
Yeah? Okay.
Makes total sense. And I'm hoping we can now talk about a solution that is planned to be workable, a single-payer system. I know that there is H.R. 676 in the House of Representatives at the moment. Can you tell us, can we start by talking about H.R. 676?
Okay, well, the new title for H.R. 676 is the U.S. National Health Care Act, or the Improved and Expanded Medicare for All.
Mm-hmm.
And so the easiest way to understand this single-payer bill is to think of Medicare, because we have a model for single-payer in the United States, and that is Medicare. We decided in 1963 that, in fact, we were going to provide universal health care to all of our seniors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it's the one true universal health care that we have, other than for veterans through the VA. But that's not a single-payer system. That is socialized medicine, actually, the VA is. But Medicare is a single-payer system. And so what H.R. 676 would do, it would expand it so that, in fact, it would cover those over 65 and under 65,
mm-hmm.
so basically from zero to death. And then it would improve it, because Medicare right now is fragmented also. There's Part A and Part B, or Part C, and now we have Part D. And it's also very privatized, unfortunately, which is increasing costs. It's an increasing administrative cost. And so what we need to do is to integrate it so that, in fact, we have a Part E for everybody. So, you know, we're going to do away with all the different parts, all the different copays, all the different coinsurance, all the different premiums that, in fact, our seniors still have to pay for Part B. And we're going to have a tax that everyone will have to pay, and that will pay for our what we call the U.S. National Healthcare Trust Fund. And from those funds, that is going to pay for the providers and the clinics and the hospitals and for long-term care and for pharmaceuticals and for mental health and for dental and vision, medical equipment, and plenty of other things. So it's going to be a very, very comprehensive plan that 95% of the people in the United States are basically going to have to pay about 5% of their income tax in order to be able to afford this.
So this would be a progressive tax?
It would be a progressive, yes. Yes, it would be a progressive tax. Mm-hmm. And it would be come from payroll so that the employer and the employee would pay. Mm-hmm. And everyone would get a health card. And you would be able to go to the doctor of your choice, not to the doctor of the choice of your insurance company or your HMO. And you would have comprehensive benefits. You'd be able to go to the hospital and get the tests that you needed to pay for the medications that you needed, to go to a clinic if you wanted to, to your subspecialist if you needed it, and then also long-term care, plus mental health parity and dental and vision. So it's a very, very comprehensive bill that, in fact, ends up being hugely less expensive for most people than what they are paying right now.
Right. Right. Anna, thank you. So this appears to be a real-world solution. Is there popular support for Medicare for All?
Actually, there is. In fact, about 62 to 65% of the U.S. public endorses a national health program that is funded through taxes. When you ask people that question, do you want a national health program that covers everybody and is paid through by taxes, then people say yes.
Right.
And there was a survey done of physicians, and this was published in Annals of Internal Medicine last year, where they found that 59% of physicians that were surveyed, in fact, support legislation for national health care. And that is a huge difference. You know, there's always been popular support for tax-financed health insurance, believe it or not. There really has been. but there has not been support among physicians for a national health bill. And now this is the first time that, in fact, we're finding that a majority of physicians now support national health insurance or national health care.
Mm-hmm. Anna, thank you. So, so special interests can sink legislation like this in a minute.
Yeah.
And the insurance industry and pharmaceutical industry, these are big elephants.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No doubt about that.
So they are, I'm guessing that those industries will be opposed to a single-payer system, and what kinds of strategies are being employed?
Well, they are vehemently opposed because you can imagine if you're making $2.2 trillion, I mean, obviously not one person, not one company is making it, but huge profits in the industry, both in the pharmaceutical industry and in the health insurance industry. So, no, they're not going to go down without a fight, for sure. However, they are actually able to read the writing on the wall. And I think that I mentioned to you that as of November 2008, the average share of prices of the top five private insurance were down by 60 to 77%.
Yes.
Compared, you know, everybody else's went down, you know, on average about 40%, but theirs actually went down even more. They're using a couple of tactics. One of them is I believe, a really sneaky tactic, and that is that they are starting to create and infiltrate grassroots movements for healthcare reform. And they're calling themselves names like Healthcare for America Now, okay, or Cover the Uninsured, And these are so-called grassroots organizations that are heavily, heavily, heavily funded, because you cannot have a grassroots organization that has a $25 million budget. Okay,
right, right.
I have never heard of one.
Right.
I'd like to belong to that. But I don't think that it exists. But these are organizations that have those kind of budgets. Very, very glossy ads in magazines and in television. And what they're doing is that they are, under the guise of healthcare reform, they are trying to infiltrate the healthcare reform movement by saying that they want to include everybody around the table, including health insurance. And so if you try, basically it's like putting a fox in a hen house and telling the fox to be in charge of the hens.
Right.
You cannot.
Right.
So there's no way that you can actually reform healthcare by trying to reform the health insurance industry. It's just not going to happen. In fact, that's what Hillary Clinton tried doing in 1993. That's what the Clintons were trying to do. And not even that much of a reform of health insurance industry. So the health insurance industry actually has got to stop providing health care. In fact, they're not providing a whole lot of health care right now, but they really have got to get out of the business of providing health care or assuming to provide health care. They can continue to provide life insurance and car insurance and flood insurance and whatever other kind, whatever other kind of insurance they sell, they can continue doing that, but not health, because health cannot be treated as a commodity.
Yes.
Health is a public good. It's a public good like education, like fire departments, like police departments, like roads and bridges and so forth. Not one person can afford to pay for and sustain the road that they drive on to work every single day. Right?
Yes.
Nobody can do that. And that's why we call it a public good, and everybody pays to have that road built and to maintain that road. And we pay through our taxes for that. Well, healthcare is a public good. I mean, beyond being a human right, it is a public good, and that's the only way that it can be afforded, because not one person in this country outside of maybe Bill Gates and Warren Buffett could actually afford to be in the ICU for 3 months.
Anna, thank you. We are right there with you. This is a terrific policy recommendation, and of course it's a real paradigm shift. So how would the country transition to a single-payer system?
You know, it would be easier than we imagine. Medicare in 1965 was instituted over 1 year. In 1 year they took on, we have about 40 million seniors and people on Medicare right now. So I honestly don't know the number, the millions of people that transitioned into Medicare in 1 year, but we were able to do it rather seamlessly in 1 year. And being that we already have a model out there, I really don't think that it's going to take us that much time. If we, in fact, decided that, yes, we were going to come up with a completely innovative model and product and so forth, I think that it would probably take us a little bit. But being that we already have the majority of physicians already accept Medicare, all hospitals practically accept Medicare. So from that end, long-term and pharmaceuticals and so forth, all that part is already taken care of, because they all accept Medicare. And so it would basically be having to come up with a mechanism to create these cards and to distribute the cards and to make sure that people, that, you know, whoever it is that's going to decide that it's going to be able to qualify to get these cards, whether it's going to be residents or permanent residents or whatever it is, will have access to this card, and then you should be able to go to your physician. And meanwhile, what happens is that this trust fund negotiates with hospitals for a global budget. And so hospitals are going to love this, because, in fact, they're going to have an entire budget to work with, not to try to guess, in fact, if the insurance company is going to reimburse them or not, and then to shift costs. And then this trust fund is also going to be negotiating with providers. And so physicians, for the very first time, are actually going to be able to sit down at the table and negotiate prices. And, you know, they're not going to get everything that they want. But it's going to be a give and take. And this can happen once a year, where there's renegotiation every year. And then physicians will know exactly how much money that they will have in a year, and they will be able to budget accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I see it as being something that is going to take a little bit of time, but it really shouldn't take us, you know, 10 years or 5 years or you know, honestly, I can't tell you exactly, but I do know that Medicare got instituted over a span of 1 year, and maybe we could use that as a model.
Thank you. So the transition is not a mystery. There's a clear way forward, and it apparently should be a smooth transition. So what can citizens do to help promote and advocate for the passage of a single-payer system?
Well, it is very, very, very important that your listeners write to their U.S. congressperson and tell them that they want to, them to support and to sign on to H.R. 676. In the 110th Congress, we had 93 co-sponsors for H.R. 676.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the new Congress, it's being reintroduced. I believe that right now we have some 30-some co-sponsors for the bill, and so we really, really need those old co-sponsors to get back and become co-sponsors again, and for people to write to their representatives and to tell them that they want them to become co-sponsors. And in addition, there is no Senate bill, and so for those that are interested in speaking with their senators, we do need to have a Senate version of the bill introduced and soon and fast.
Anna, thank you so much. We have a little bit of time left. I'm hoping you can tell us about the mission and activities of Physicians for a National Health Program.
Oh, sure. I'd love to. Well, as you know, I'm past president. It was a huge honor to be president for 2 years. We are an organization of 15,000 physicians and other health providers across the United States. We have a mission to promote single-payer national health program, and we've been doing so since 1988. And we are the one physician organization that has been steadfastly been promoting single-payer. We published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1989 where we had the physician's proposal, and that's where we actually proposed something very similar to H.R. 676 in 1989. And we have a huge research arm. We have people that publish in Health Affairs, the New England Journal of Medicine, and JAMA, and all the peer-reviewed journals. And we really do have the evidence on our side that, in fact, our healthcare system right now is falling apart, and the only way to truly have an accountable, affordable, accessible, universal, comprehensive, and equitable healthcare system is to have a single-payer system.
Anna, thank you so much for a terrific conversation and an expert analysis of these policy issues.
Well, I hope that I was clear. Sometimes it seems like it's a little bit difficult and complex, but I really do believe that if you break this down into its separate parts, that people can understand. They can understand what is wrong and how to go about fixing it.
Yes, this is very clear, Anna. Thank you. Our guest is Dr. Anna Malinow, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine and past President of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thanks for being with us on Science and Society.
It's been a real pleasure, David. Thank you again.